Welcome to Just Another Wine Podcast. Here we are again. I'm Emily Harmon.
I'm Doug Rigg.
And I'm Jamie Good.
Yeah. And we interrupt each other a lot. You can
and we're all very eager here. Yes.
So we've got a very interesting topic to discuss today. And, well, I think it's really interesting, but maybe for some people you might think it's not so interesting. But the topic is vessels of élevage or barrels.
Aging
wine. Not just aging, but fermenting as well, I guess, for some. Mm. So we're talking about
the journey of wine before bottle.
Yes. From grapes to bottle.
Yep.
And what happens. And this is really, I think, a really interesting topic. And it's kind of unique to wine. Maybe it's not unique to wine, but I think it's this idea that you know, you're taking the grapes from the vineyard and you want to express the vineyard, the variety, the place in the final wine. So how do you get there? And traditionally with wine, we've got this very unusual situation, which is that with wine, you're not allowed to add any flavour to the wine. It's just got to come from the grapes. But historically, barrels have been used in raising wines. Mm-hmm. So fermenting whites and aging reds. And barrels are made of oak usually, and the oak
can be treated in lots of different ways.
In its preparation, yeah, is heated in some way, so like over a flame or over steam to bend the staves to make the barrel, and then that act creates something in the wood that then gets transferred to the wine. And so a very significant flavor element in many wines comes from an extrinsic source, which is the barrels. And then you've got, like, you know, derived from that, because barrels are allowed in wine, oak is allowed in wine, so you've got oak chips, you've got, you know, even oak essence, staves, all these ways of using oak products to give flavour to wine. So this is the legal thing, legal way you're allowed to flavour wine. So this is kind of an anomaly, I think, in some ways.
Then we have different types of oak, but then yeah, we also have different types of wood that are, yes, also allowed, which have different impacts.
Yeah, I mean, and actually oak is, you know, making a barrel, being a cooper, is it may be a disappearing art, but it's so valued by so many winemakers that we work with. They choose, they select a style of oak or many different styles of oak because it gives them options. They'll select maybe a proportion of new and oak barrels. Once they find a cooper that they really love to work with, they'll probably stick with that cooper. If you're in Austria and you love Austrian oak, you feel that, in a way, the barrels there, made by two very famous barrel producers, complement the wine. In fact, they wouldn't dream of making, most of them would not dream of making some of their, you know, more intense, long-lived wines without working with Stockinger or whoever the alternative,
Pasha,
yeah, with these barrels. And they're beautiful. And it's, sometimes they have the barrels built specially to complement their wine. So the barrel makers taste the wine and then want to sort of figure out what to do. Sometimes it's the shape of the barrels, the size of the barrels. Are they, you know, 600 litres, 1200? Are they foudre? Are they vertical barrels? Are they ovals? You know, there's so much to talk about when you talk about oak. And we're not going to just talk about oak because there are other various types of vessel.
But oak's a good starting point.
It is a very good starting point.
And I think the, you know, you know, you can dial down in detail quite a lot. I went to a tannery, Mercure, to see barrels being made. And that was a fascinating process because it's an insanely skillful process to take these, you know, staves of wood. So oak, you know, it's split, then yep, it's put into staves, and then you kind of get these staves, and together, all these different staves will create something that's watertight. And, you know, it's an insanely skillful process. But then beyond just the forest of origin, because they talk about that a lot, you know, you've got, well, basically you've got the source of oak. So French
all
oak.
All the source of wood.
Or American oak. So Quercus alba or Quercus sicilis, or, you know, they give quite different flavour impacts. But then you've got the forest, but even terroir impacts. So I tasted through some wines at Fechelecken where they've got one of their coopers has given them.
It's a South African producer for anybody that's
not familiar. And in the cellar, that some of the barrels that Luke, the winemaker, has been given to work with are like not just forest origin, but they're different terroirs. Mm. So the actual soil that the oak trees grows in affects the way the oak tree grows. Then when you make the barrels from those staves,
going to affect the grain.
Yeah.
Because how fast they grow and how slow they grow.
So you can dial down to a lot of details. So this is nothing to do with grapes and wine. This is an extrinsic influence on flavour. But it's become part of the tradition of wine, that for many wine styles, oak is an important aspect of the flavour. But then, of course, we're not just talking about flavour impact of oak. We're also talking about the fact that an oak barrel is not totally impermeable, that some oxygen will get into the wine. And then we start talking about the size of the barrel, which I think is a very... Doug, you alluded to this earlier, you know, there's this idea you can work with foudre, you can work with puncheons, you can work with...
tonneaux.
Yeah.
And it's really, in certain regions, very controversial, like Barolo, where they've traditionally favoured Slavonian...
Botti,
which are huge, and you know, they're not new, but obviously,
and also chestnut as well. No,
this is true, but obviously, during, shall we say, parkerization, for want of a better word, the sort of move towards finer, more structured wines, then like smaller and smaller barrels. So, in a way, a lot of wines in international style was created to ape Bordeaux and Burgundy to a lesser extent, using small barrels to give more influence of oak, whereas these like larger, these botti were extraordinary. I mean, you know, like and you can so easily recognize a wine which is made in the traditional style to wines which are made in a much more sort of modern style. Mm. And I Northern Rhone, I find that as well. You know, there's the new wave of, you know, people producing Côte Rôti and the traditionalists, basically. So your oak choice really, you know, puts you in one camp or another. And I can understand why people will play around with formats, but I like to think that barrels are traditional. The type of barrel you use is traditional to your culture, your wine culture and your region. And I find it very fascinating when you talk about that even the wood has a sort of like a imprint of terroir. Yeah. And it's about this liaison, because we're not talking about oak adding value, but adding something. Again, I'm going to use the word beautiful, but beautifully textural to the wine, harmonizing with it over a period of time so that you don't notice the oak, but it's there. It has a wonderful presence, as opposed to being this dominant, quite spicy, spiky force. And so we'll discuss whether we think how beneficial it is and how oak compares to other formats and what those formats confer to the wine as well, because every format will confer something, even by absence of obviousness, there'll be something conferred. So should we,
it might be a weird way to taste, because we want to talk about different vessels, but should we start with the oaky or the oaked option, the wine that's in oak? What do you think?
So, yeah, I think the thing about barrels is, you know, I guess for a while I was kind of like in the camp of, I think new oak is a terrible thing because of the flavour impact. And because, you know, new barrels were associated with, you know, the kind of modernising force in wine. We talked about Barolo, which is very interesting. The Barolo situation is very interesting because small barrels became a political thing. There was one producer who had a cuvée which is no barrels, no Berlusconi. So basically, the small oak was associated with Berlusconi fans, the right wing, and the large format traditional was associated with politically left-leaning sort of influences in Barolo. So it's more than modernists or traditionalists. It was you were a left or right, you know, in terms of your politics, which is a fascinating overlay on the discussion. Suffice to say, with Barolo now and Piemonte, I think we've gone past that traditionalist modernist divide, and I think you've got neo traditionalists, neo modernists.
There's now a whole spectrum.
So people who've taken chainsaws to destroy their botti and replace them with new oak now have bought new large format oak as well, you know, and I think that that's a healthy correction. I think it's this idea that, and I thought for a long time that small oak, new oak is a terrible thing and it's awful, but now I think sometimes it's an appropriate way to raise a wine for certain wine styles.
Okay, so let's discuss what new oak confers to the wine in terms of its flavour and texture. Either of you want to tee off on that?
I mean, I think we know that it gives a, depending on the type of oak, or let's just say new wood, because there's lots of different types of wood, so I don't want to just isolate it just as oak, but depending on the origin, there's often that sweet spice, sometimes an amplified fruit profile, sometimes almost like a sexiness to the fruit profile as well, because it does lift all of that, so it feels a little bit sometimes on the, let's say, the initial impact of the wine or the initial experience of the wine, sometimes a primariness, a generosity, an abundance of like a sweet flavor that's there, or sometimes an obvious fruit note that I definitely see in oaky wines. But then it also, depending on like the char, the toast, all those things, then you get those toastiness, sometimes nuttiness, like these secondary flavors. And then we've got the structure that comes with it, and also the development of flavors that comes from wine spending time in wood as well, right? Like, which can be interesting, not necessarily with brand new oak, but then if we start working with different degrees of aging on oak, it can be very helpful.
But do wines necessarily need more time to digest new oak? I mean, you would not particularly want to drink them when they're in their infancy, because they would be very...
It depends. I think let's talk about reds rather than whites, because I think they're both obviously have new oak influences. Certainly for Chardonnay, oak is quite an important component of the many Chardonnay wine styles. But I think for reds, I think some reds can just soak it up, it seems, and they can have lots of new... They can have 100% new oak, but still not be dominated by that oak. Other reds are much more fragile, and you stick new oak on them, and it really is...
Nebbiolo is one of those grapes where it's very obvious, yeah. I think.
And then we talk about the big distinction is between American and French oak. Obviously, we get Eastern European oak as well. That's a slightly different sort of flavour, but the American oak is often has a lot more sort of vanilla coconut character. The oak lactones are responsible for that. And so the good example of American oak that sometimes can work really well is in Rioja. And in Rioja, the wines often spend a lot of time in American oak, and not necessarily new American oak, but it still imparts this flavour impact that does take time to integrate.
But do we we're so conscious of the oak in La Rioja. Do we lose the grape variety? Do I even know what Tempranillo tastes like? And do we lose any terroir?
Totally, flavor? Yeah. No, it's in some ways it's the... If you think of terroir as sense of place, the sense of place is kind of partly the cellar and partly the vineyard. But I think that the big problem for me with Rioja is that you've got these fantastic vineyards and it's all lost in the way that the wine is produced. So a lot of big companies...
Because of the vessel.
Partly because of the vessel. And also the fact that when I first went to a big Rioja winery, they had like 10,000 barrels. I said... Coming as a very naive person, coming from having visited lots of wineries in Australia, and they'll say, well, how do you topple those barrels up? And they looked at me like I was stupid. And so basically what they do is that they don't top any barrels, they just leave them. And every 6 months, they don't even taste the barrels, they just rack them into another barrel and add some more sulfites. And so it's oxidative, that whole transfer. So every 6 months. So depending on the age, you know, whether it's a Crianza or
Makes sense for the style that you taste quite frequently, yeah.
So you've got this oxidative racking and you've got adding sulfites there. And so what you do is it's a kind of almost an industrial process. And what it does, it results in wines that are distinctive. They taste off the place, Rioja. I don't know.
Because they've got this developed character because of that, yeah.
And sometimes they reach this beautiful mellow harmony with aging because they've seen so much oxygen in the élevage because of this six-monthly... sort of like racking, aerative racking, they kind of just keep on developing. But I'm not sure whether this is the this is a legitimate style, but I'm not sure it's something I'm that interested in.
Maybe also just on the oak point, it's also worth throwing in things of, if we move away a little bit from new oak as just the strong example, if we think of regions like the Jura and we think of wines like Vangeon and some of the more oxidative wines where people are using barrels that are like, I mean, sometimes they look like centuries old, don't they? Because they're like black. They are black. They are old. They're like the really like, you know, heirlooms, these barrels. That they look kind of unhygienic sometimes. But like these barrels also contain a lot of characteristics that are collected over this time that then influence the wine as well.
This so is that what can I be very intriguing. About. Yeah, to mention is that if you buy Jura barrels and take them somewhere else, which some people do, or you make Sauvignon and Chardonnay in a Sauvignon barrel, my God, they taste the same. You know, like it's amazing because the barrels have a memory of what was in them before and the previous vintage. So there's a lot of this like nutty thing that goes on in Jura Chardonnays, but they're not like they're not a Sauvignon, they're not a Vangeon style. They just they're being impregnated with a yeast, the sort of floor element that was perhaps in that barrel before. Because I don't suppose if you're a small producer, you can sort of necessarily pick and choose. Those are my Chardonnay barrels, those are my Sauvignon barrels. They're the same barrels, usually. They just get interchanged. And so maybe there is a terroir element in the wood, or at least a memory of previous vintages, which is conferred.
The great example of this, though, is the Criadera system, you know, in Jerez. And the whole second terroir of the cellar, and these barrels are insane. They're very old, and they have people who repair them and keep them, and they're worth a lot of money, these old barrels, these sherry butts. And what's fascinating is the Scotch whiskey industry has a lot of whiskies that are barrels, but they're not the real genuine sherry barrels that you get in the bodegas, because those are prized, they're really expensive. What they have is they have people who make barrels and put some sherry through them and sell them to Scotland. And that's actually a very profitable arm of an industry that isn't always so profitable. But in those old, bodegas, the sherry bodegas, and or in Sanlúcar, you go in there and it's like this is a special terroir. And those barrels are an intrinsic part of that. And when some people make the unfortified palominos using these sherry butts, they often have a little ghost of the sherry to them. Then that's quite interesting. You can almost taste the little ghost of the sherry that's come from those barrels. It's what you were talking about with the
but they're very the yeast, special barrels as well. Like I think it's like interesting you said with the yeast, because I've also heard from a few producers in the region how they'll also talk about certain walls of the cellar
having certain characteristics
in wine.
So we went to visit Emilio Hidalgo in Jerez, and they did have some vineyards once upon a time. They said, we don't talk about vineyards now. We talk about the walls of the cellar, north, south, east, west, because there's different levels of humidity on each wall and different amounts of light, but also different according to how high the barrels are.
It gets warmer as it goes up,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yeah. So they taste every barrel, and they do these like weird hieroglyphic annotations about what's in. And they taste dozens of times, hundreds of times probably, to sort of feel what's happening, the development in the barrel. But the barrel is part of this amazing cellar, and each part of the cellar, you can almost feel it, you know, like as you walk through it, has a different character. And that's the terroir. It's the terroir that's enabling these yeast cultures to grow in these particular ways. And they are just monitoring it. And and the barrels are fundamental to this, because every barrel is reacting differently. Quite extraordinary when you think about it. But it's like the microclimate of a vineyard. Yeah. Every vine is different, but we don't spend time on each vine.
So when I first started visiting wineries, I should say, what I found was that there were like two ways of élevage in the wineries. So the wineries would have like stainless steel tanks, and they'd have small oak barrels.
Mm.
Fast forward to now, and when you go to a winery, even if it's a big commercial winery, it's like going in the old days, it'd be like you're going to into a kitchen, you'd see a frying pan and a
big pot, and that's
a pot. That's it. Now you go in, there's all sorts of different pots and pans and everything. It's like a kitchen where you've got all these tools for cooking, and you go into the winery and you'll see so many different options in terms of élevage. So you'll see the small oak barrel, you see the large oak. Large oak is becoming much more popular. It's very trendy. Then you'll see...
other types of wood.
Yes.
So acacia, chestnut. I've even seen mahogany.
I've seen cherry as well.
Yeah, cherry is a bit more common, actually, then. But mahogany...
Mahogany, where?
And Adega de Colares in Colares.
Ah, very cool.
They have a lot of exotic woods because they shipped a lot of woods from South America, actually, through trading via Portugal back then. So they actually have, like,
what
these
sort
crazy...
What trading was it?
Like, trading woods, woods coming, exotic woods, like mahogany, for example, coming from South America to mainland Europe, and Portugal being... one of the main drop-off points because they're big in the tree.
I remember when I went to Mayakamas the first time, they had these fermentation vats. There was a certain sort of wood that they were made of. I forgot what it's called. But then another sort of wood for the fermentation vats. But it's like, so lots of different sorts of wood.
Yeah.
Then obviously concrete, which is back to the future, because a lot of wineries, like if you go to a big cooperative winery or a large winery, anywhere, you'd have seen the old cellar would have been full of concrete tanks.
Being an old Bordeaux, even the great old Bordeaux was vinified in concrete.
And then concrete, and now concrete is back, and you've got all sorts of different concrete now, and
different
famously
shapes.
The non-blow
eggs.
Concrete eggs, or Sonoma cast stone do the eggs as well. And then obviously not just concrete, but we're going to terracotta, amphora.
Clay.
Clay.
So amphoras, also known as tinajas, or quevri.
Quevri in Georgia, talhas in Portugal.
Novum now in Oregon.
Yes.
Yes.
So Andrew Beckham,
yes.
makes these beautiful vessels then Oregon. Yeah. And this is you know, these things are cropping up in Artinova, they make some as well. And I remember we were in Tuscany, Emily, last year, and there was this
Chianti.
Artist who was making one.
Just for his mate, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
There was a guy who's just like a ceramicist that started making a clay vessel for his friend, and he'd done all this very elaborate painting.
Painted on the outside. And,
it was kind of cool.
Quite a character.
Yeah.
And don't forget glass. Fiberglass and glass jars.
Well, fiberglass is the old-fashioned.
Demijohns.
Back with champagne in particular, a lot of people making small-batch glass.
Now we've got the wine globes.
They're
cropping up everywhere.
Yeah.
Yes.
And beautiful, but very expensive and obviously a little bit fragile. And then not to be ignored as well is a variation on clay is ceramic. So clavers becoming quite popular.
Yeah, yes. Also in places like Czechia, I've seen that quite a lot. Like Peter Korob's got big ceramic vessels.
But also, I suppose it depends,
stainless steel we haven't mentioned as well.
Yeah, but we'll come back to that. Fino Diana, they use the wine globes. But when you're doing a micro-vinification, you're only making the best part of, 100 litres.
Then a demijohn, yeah.
Then you can use demijohns.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it makes sense to use these other formats because you cannot fill even a fraction of a barrel with them. So you need all these options to be able to if you want to vinify a particular plot. That makes a lot of sense and gives a lot of individuality.
But then a further twist on this is when you're talking about clay or concrete is whether or not the clay or concrete is lined.
Mm.
Because there's all sorts of things you can paint it in tartaric acid, you can line it with epoxy, and then it's very neutral, it's like glass then, or stainless steel.
Yeah.
But then also, if it's clay, let's say, is it buried or not? Is it above the ground or not?
Well, that's
also going to have
Georgian,
a big impact.
And the Marani, the quevri are buried, so that's going to have a big impact.
And they're also lined with beeswax, which creates its own problems in terms of cleaning as well.
It's quite an elaborate protocol.
And then you have to clean with
lime.
I've
got a book, actually, about how to maintain Georgian quevri. It's quite explicit in what you need to do. It's very interesting. It's not a simple process, you know.
No.
And I think that... I know that Ben Walgate put some quevri into the ground and Murani in Tillingham.
Mm.
And he was later on finding out this is a very complicated thing to make clean wines from after a few years. You know, it's not straightforward.
They also have to be really good. And when they're made, there's only a few people who make them and really understand how to make them because, they can get infected by bacteria if you don't clean them. So, and that can just ruin everything. So, I mean, it goes without saying that stainless is probably the easiest to maintain and that, you know, quevri are the most difficult because they're underground as well. But you still have to maintain hygiene in barrels as well. So
I'd like to add another thing because I just feel like if we're going into the vessel talk, then I definitely think we should add stone because that would then include things like palmettos, sometimes like and traditional vessels in different places. There's a couple of producers. There's one which I think is in the north of Spain, Castellancus, who do like ferment literally in the like hollowed out rock face.
Well, yeah, if you go to Rioja, you'll find these as well. It's basically a sort of series of chiseled out lagars. They're like shallow lagars, a bit like the Portuguese lagars, but carved into the rock face.
So yeah, you have that.
You do the vinification in that. Yeah. And I guess the palmetto is like that, yeah?
Yeah.
So it's like you're doing this. You're basically, the ancient way of making wine would have presumably been to bring your grapes along, foot tread them, whether they're white or red. Foot tread them, then drain off the juice and then ferment off the skins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the red wines in the past would have been a lighter star red.
And the whites would have been more like an orange.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which is, yeah, sort of what people are trying to get back to, weirdly. But yeah, there was like gravity, flow by gravity within. Yeah.
So but it's a fantastic way of making. I think the lagars, and I spend a lot of time in Portugal, and I think the lagar is used cleverly, is a brilliant tool for making wine. Mm. This shallow.
Should we taste some wines out of different vessels?
So let's
we've got
start.
A few here. Where should we start? Maybe.
Let's start with the Tinaja. And the wine we're going to taste is De Martino's Viejas Tinajas Muscat 2013. So this comes from the Tata Valley. So Tata is like down in the south of Chile. It's grapevines that are dry grown. They're usually bush vines, unsupported. They can be very old. Farming is often with horses, you know, ploughing, and they do a lot of turning the soil just before the rainy season, just before the growing season. Just before the rains come, before the growing season, to absorb the rain and to deal with the weeds. And De Martino, actually, they have a whole collection of these very old clay sort of amphoras they call Tinajas. But they're based in Maipo, the winery in Maipo. So they take the grapes up to Maipo and they have the cellar there. And what's very interesting is when you've put the grapes in there, they just leave them in there and they put a lid on and they put fresh clay over the top of the lid. So it's like, it doesn't harden so much, it's not fired, but that clay is what keeps the oxygen out of the wine.
A bit like the Georgian way of doing it, but above ground as opposed to...
And using clay instead of like beeswax or whatever.
I think on top, the Georgians would bury it and they would put a stone on top and they put clay on top
or sand.
Of that.
But I thought clay they sand, but yeah. I thought they did the clay top and then they also sealed it with like beeswax.
I don't know because they dig up the taste the wine. It's
So this is the interesting thing about this though is this is a wine I bought a long time ago, but this is the 2013 vintage. So this is a wine that probably wasn't meant to age,
but you've aged it.
I've aged it. So let's see what it's like.
So this is Muscatel or Muscat of Alexandria, which is brought
fermented. Yeah,
to Chile. Yep, 6 months. 6 months on skins. I mean, I don't know how the fermentation probably takes about 3 weeks or something.
So this is almost like the Georgian process, but the Tinajas is above ground.
Yeah, so it's fermented in Tinajas and aged in Tinajas. And as Jamie said, these are old bush vines because Muscatel was brought by the Spanish settlers in the 16th century. And this is the part of Chile that they colonized way back when. And so De Martino hocking back at the traditions, you know, they say, you know, the past is our future, you know, like Itata was just being farmed by, you know, the sort of, what do you call them, like cowboys almost, you know, people be farming on horse, the old bush vines and making wine for the table. And it's wonderful that, you know, they really, De Martino pioneered going back down there and rediscovering, and so many other wineries have followed suit.
And there's a vibrant scene down there. One of my favourites is Leo Arazzo.
Yes.
He's making some amazing wines.
Work with him,
But there's I went there a couple of years ago and met with maybe 20 different producers, and it's so exciting to see this, you know, really vibrant scene, because most of the people who are making wine there are trying to make it naturally.
Yes.
Mm.
They're not.
They're
not making techno wines, you know.
No, and people are not, I mean, if they use oak, they use the Rowley, you know, sort of the traditional barrels. So
And there was a shortage of tinajas, but suddenly everyone seems to have discovered them. And for Muscat, it seems to work really well with this skin fermentation.
Well, in Italy, the Zibibo.
It's the same, yes.
And also in Australia, Brash Higgins. Incredible, skin fermented Zibibo there. Muscat is a great variety that I think flourishes when you ferment on the skins.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to be careful because sometimes it can be overwhelmingly bitter. Like, so there's a bit of managing that with the tannin, but definitely that lifted aromatics in general, I think, work really well. As
what is great about this is that Itata is essentially, I wouldn't call it cool climate, but it's on the cooler side. It never gets more than 30 degrees in the summer. It rains more than Manchester. It's very green, very rolling, as Jamie said. These are old vines. These are self-regulating. You don't get high alcohols in Pais and Sanso and Moscatel. So you get lovely balance. And you can actually, then you can work with the grape variety. In Muscat, as you both said, it's like it works so well with skin contact. The other place in southern Spain, Alicante, and that sort of area.
Yeah.
But this is still really alive.
But maybe we talk a little bit about amphora, because my experience of wines that are aged in amphora or fermented and aged in amphora is that what I really appreciate about them is the textural element that you get from working with amphora, like often, especially with skin contact wines as well, which sometimes maybe when they're fermented and aged in oak versus amphora, that there's like a silky suppleness texturally that can be very interesting from working with clay. However, often I feel that a lot of people talk about clay as something that doesn't impact flavor. And I can say from my own experience, actually, it can, and that can be a wine fault, actually. Like, I've tried a number of Georgian wines where the clay characteristic in the wine is so dominant that actually I think it can be problematic as well. And there's
The lining or the coating of the inside of the vessel. So that varies. I mean, in the Alentejo, where they have the talias, the traditional coating is what's called page. And this is a blend of resin and other stuff that then is coated on the inside of the talia, and if it's done well, it's not noticeable. But if it's done carelessly or it's too intense, then this can affect the flavour. And then we need to talk about firing temperatures as well, because with these clay vessels, the firing temperature determines how much oxygen will come through. Because these are not totally inert vessels; they allow some oxygen through. And the higher the firing temperature, the less oxygen gets through to the wine. So controlled firing is quite important if you want to know what sort of characteristics your clay or terracotta vessel is going to have. And so this is another interesting element that I think needs to be discussed.
I think the Georgian ones, I mean, they are fired at high temperature, like 1100, I think, centigrade.
But they're fired in such a way so that they'll maybe have like seven or eight of them in this kind of like
house
kiln. It's almost, it looks like a house. And then the fire goes for 3 days, and it's like so your skill in terms of maintaining the temperature is going to really affect the property of those vessels.
There's only
three people in the whole
three people making... and they study for like 30 or 40 years, and why it's UNESCO peculiar heritage thing. I mean, there's other properties, obviously, of clay. The size, tinajas tend to be quite small. I mean, 300 litres, 350 or something like that.
Yeah.
But obviously, Kvevri can be
couple of thousand.
Two, 3,000
I think the biggest liters. Is like 3,000, which is huge.
Yes. Yeah. But I guess they're mostly for storage. So they will ferment in one vessel and maybe rack into to a big Kvevri where it will just remain. But there's just different shapes as well. Yeah. You know, Kvevri's different shape.
I mean, in Bordeaux, I've seen some that are like 250 litres, but they've got a small opening like a barrel hole.
Yes.
And in the top. So they're quite different to the wide opening on the talias or the amphora. And also the other thing is that in Portugal, traditionally, these weren't sealed. They would just be like a flycatcher on the top, but they would be open. And then sometimes they'd use olive oil on the top of the
wine. That's a traditional all the way back to Etruscan times, actually.
And what they do is they'd make the wine, so that usually with all the skins and everything and the stems, and then like it's the 13th of November, St. Martin's Day, is when the talliers will be tapped. And so it's almost like there's some restaurants you can still go to in Vidigueira, around Vidigueira and Cuba in Alentejo, where they have these restaurants where you go in there and you can drink straight from the talia. So it's really cool. If you go, I think you need to go there before like May or something, when they'll run out. Or the...
Do you remember like Anton von Klopper and Tom Shebrook were part of a group called Void?
Yeah, they used to do
Natural Wine Selection Theory. And they used to do this cuvee called Voice of the People.
And they drove like to Melbourne. And this is when I was living in Melbourne. And they'd drive to Melbourne and they'd made like this big massive tank glass, of wine just covered in
massive olive glass, oil and just pour thing. Out of it.
I think
with
it was
olive oil.
It was a demijohn with a tap at the bottom.
A demijohn with a tap, and the olive oil was on the top. And so basically, when people ordered a glass of wine, it would be poured out of there. And I said, "What happens when the olive oil got to the bottom?" And they said, "Excellent salad dressing."
I mean, this is Australians.
Fantastic. I love this sort of thing. It's not good. It's like that's an interesting wine. I think we should maybe move on and talk about this next wine is a wine from Rioja, which is normally associated with oak aging. And this is from Ramon Bilbao, and the wine is called Madurado en Homizón. It's very hard to read. And 100 months. So this is Garnacha, which is interesting for Rioja. Garnacha is a grape variety, I think, that should be more widely planted in Rioja.
Okay.
Fantastic grape variety. Obviously, Rioja has moved steadily more in favour of Tempranillo.
Yeah.
And this is 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 100 months in concrete. So that's the interesting thing here, is you've got a region that's normally associated with oak, but they've aged this wine for 100 months in concrete.
Are we doing that before that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is this classified as a Crianza or a Reserva, or does it have any designation?
No, just Rioja.
Just Rioja.
Yeah.
Because there's no oak, so it can't go into any of the other categories.
So this is a region, you know, that's become, you know, so associated with this means of élevage, which is small oak barrels, and particularly small American oak. That it's kind of hard to see it getting away from it. But before the so basically Bordeaux winemakers turned up there when Phylloxera hit Bordeaux, looking to make Bordeaux lookalike wines in Rioja, because the market needed them. And that's when everything changed in Rioja. Before that, there was a lot more diversity of grape varieties. Élevage wasn't in oak. Élevage was often in concrete. Wines were often moved around in pig skins. I went to a small winery, so people would often make the wine in their, you know, their cellars attached to their homes, and then the wine would be transported in a pig skin, which is a really cool way of transporting wine. It would be full of wine, and pig skins about 80 kilos. You're quite strong, so it's like a way of transporting wine, not for aging wine, but just for moving it. And it's kind of like you'd skin the pig and turn it inside out and then sew it all the bits where the wine could leak out of. But anyway, that's a side point. This wine, I think, is kind of interesting because this idea of moving away from oak élevage for a grape variety, Garnacha, which I think Garnacha is a little fragile sometimes. It doesn't like small oak.
Also, it's quite prone to oxidation.
Yeah.
So, I've had a lot of oxidized Garnacha lately.
So using concrete for Garnacha is quite a cool thing.
I mean, Commando G, big advocates for a lot of concrete in the cellars, no?
Yeah, and 500-600-litre barrels. Large barrels. Wood. Yeah. I don't know whether it's a terroir thing or not, actually. Maybe altitude and Garnacha works as a beautiful combination, and then I would never use new wood. I mean, it's not my decision, but I wouldn't use new oak on Grenache because it's too fragile. This is darker than some. I still feel, you know, it's
brambly, more brambly.
Yeah,
and more concentrated. I also think, I don't know, I've definitely observed that in the last decade, a lot more producers in warmer climates are using concrete for their reds rather than wood. And it seems like there's a collective understanding that maybe in warmer regions, moving away from oak to extract more doesn't necessarily make sense if you want to make a more balanced, poised, let's say, purer style of wine, that actually maybe using oak makes a little bit more sense in cooler climates. But
yes,
that's a broad stroke statement.
I remember Evan Suddy saying to me once, they said that an oak barrel is a way of ripening a wine, and it makes sense in Bordeaux. You know, it really makes sense in Bordeaux that you've got the élevage in small oak. It does really help. So I think and Burgundy seems to do very well for Pinot Noir with small oak. But in other regions where there's a bit more warmth, then you don't need that extra ripening effect.
And you don't need more concentration because you've already got that from the sunshine.
Yeah. But with the, you know, climate change and Bordeaux making 14.5% wines easily in Burgundy, do we need it? I mean, are they just using this super ripeness as an excuse to use more oak? Conversely, are we not finding in Spain in particular, where I've always found growers have a love affair with oak in certain regions.
Oh, with Barrio del Duero, it's insane.
Yes.
That's like,
but seriously? In certain parts of Spain, yeah. I think there's a bit of a moving away, you know, moving back to, I mean, we work with a producer in Rioja who works with Amphora and elsewhere, you know, using different formats to sort
which
of like
produces make that the wine. Illusion?
Sorry?
Which producer?
That one. Alonso Pedraja.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the wines are just so much lighter and brighter and, you know, more vivacious for the fact that they're not, you know, swamped in oak. And
So what about the heresy of doing red wines in stainless steel?
Okay, well, this comes back to something that I believe, which is a bit quirky on me. I may have mentioned earlier this evening.
Shall I pour your wine for us, Doug?
Oh, yes, please. Is that I like my red wines to taste like white wines and my white wines to taste like red wines. So I like my white wines to be textural. So I don't mind oak as a sort of like, not a flavouring, but as a textural sort of warming element. But for red wines, I love this red fruit and I love coolness and freshness and lift and focus. And I love, you know, that the way that stainless steel seems to sort of almost grip and compress the wine into a sort of into the red fruit spectrum rather than allow, you know, sometimes oak I think makes wines flabby and like, you know, lack of corsetry. I love precision in red wine making. I'm into sort of elegance. Mondeuse is quite, we're tasting a Mondeuse at the moment.
So the wine we're tasting is from Domaine Louis
Magnan,
and it's a Vin de Savoie Arbin.
Is the village, yep.
And it's a Mondeuse 2003 Vieille Vigne. And it weighs
This is a crazy wine.
It weighs 12.5% alcohol.
From the warmest vintage of the last something 20 odd years.
And this
where everybody dies.
This is raised in stainless steel.
Yes. And then in bottle. And I think it's kept its focus and precision and elegance. You know, all things I really love in red wine. It makes it drinkable to me. The acidity is very fine. The tannins are granular, but very fine.
They are granular. They're kind of grainy and gravelly, aren't
yes,
they?
Yes, yeah. Which I think is actually very much Mondeuse and Pastoa.
Helps to, with the freshness, I think. It's a wine that's 22, almost 22 years old. It's got a lovely black cherry, blackberry fruit character, but with freshness, with this chalkiness and this graveliness. It almost makes me think of Bordeaux varieties in terms of that sort of that grainy, as you say, granular tannic structure.
But could we imagine it in another format? Can we imagine it in oak, what that might do to it?
I think it would have gone mushy by this stage.
Yeah.
Oak would have made it go soft and formless. And I think the fact that the, you know, obviously red wine tannins in stainless steel can often be a little unresolved and a bit grainy and grippy. But when you're keeping a wine 20 years...
And not even from a shape perspective like you're talking about. I'm also thinking from a flavour perspective that like this with an oxidative edge, I just don't really feel like it would be very pleasant.
But it's also what you feel like a wine from Savoie, a mount, you know, high altitude mountainous region where where I think you're expecting all the wines to have this, I don't know, glacial,
a pristine, clean, cleanliness.
Glacial purity. Yeah. And I really like that, even though it's Mondo's is on the darker side of the fruit spectrum. It's still like fine and fresh.
Mondo's can lose its focus quite easily and become quite flabby, can't it?
Yeah.
So this is a beautiful example of this.
It can be quite wild, and this is like still quite.
It's a very drinkable, digestible wine. It's nutritious.
And I guess I sort of like, I had this like weird feeling about stainless steel. It's like, I don't really like to see it. I feel it's like soulless, it's mechanical. And then, as I say, for whites, I tend not to favour it. I don't know what it is. I find that like, I remember like Dominique Belloir who, you know, passed away in 2020, saying that I don't like stainless steel because it kills the wine, and this is white wine, and I don't like wood because it superimposes on the wine, which is why he eventually ended up with this Noblo eggs, and they just seem to be perfect for his particular Savoie white grape variety, because
Granger.
Oh, so the wines had fantastic. They were precise, but they had amplitude as well.
Yep.
So they grew layer upon layer. But his Mondeuse was quite similar to this. It was very pretty, very precise. I think he actually worked with Amphora for his for a bit, although he didn't always get on with them. But I just think stainless works well for the reds from this region.
Very nice wine. Thank you very much for sharing it. And
you're welcome.
It's still got...
That's
no, it doesn't
treat.
Feel like it's past its best either. So we've got one last wine.
Last wine, we're going to head towards some oak territory. So a classic wine, a very well-known wine that is raised in small oak barrels with a good proportion of me. And this is from Spanish wine company Torres. It is the Masla Plana 2018. From Penedès. This is a famous wine that kind of debuted in, I think, 1970. The idea was that Torres, at that stage, you know, in Spain, people weren't taking Spanish wine seriously from Penedès, and Torres thought, well, we're going to make a Cabernet Sauvignon that will take the world by storm. So this is Cabernet Sauvignon-based wine, matured in small oak.
This is French oak, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And... you know, this is a wine that in its time made a huge impact and raised the profile of Spanish wines quite a bit, because internationally it was very successful. So let's open it off, yeah, and see what it's like. The influence of élevage in small oak.
I can say to our listener that this will be the first Cabernet Sauvignon I've tried in about 5 years.
Yes, Doug, sue me. Doug's already getting triggered by this wine, I think.
This will be the first Cabernet Sauvignon I've had from Penedès in a long time. You said from Penedès, right?
Yes. It's a really nice vineyard, and they're starting to do some quite interesting work with regenerative projects.
Yeah, I've seen that also.
Organics.
Really de-alkalized wine as well, right? Yeah.
Maybe less interesting then.
Alcoholic wine only.
So, quite brooding, and I think the effect of the small oak is often to fix the colour and the structure.
Yeah.
Especially when a warm climate wine like this.
I mean, it's kind of another, it's like day and night, the two wines that we just tried side by side, right? Because the Mondeuse is so fresh and bright and energetic, and this is, you know, it's
a richer wine.
Bigger, textural.
It's got sleek and blackcurrant fruits and blackberry.
But again, that kind of going back to what we talked about at the beginning, this sort of flashy fruit up front, no?
Is this sort of... I mean, because I don't drink Bordeaux, so you two will have to abuse me or disabuse me of this. Is this more typical of modern style Bordeaux? Because like
this is quite different.
I think it's really different.
I grew up on quite weedy, herbaceous style of
no.
You know.
So Bordeaux certainly went through a phase of getting riper and richer, But I think Bordeaux has kind of made a little correction. I taste the...
There's some really good wines.
The wine's in bottle now. I think that Bordeaux, there's a lot of money in Bordeaux. There's a lot of smart people, a lot of intelligent people. And they're not all chasing the critic scores. That sort of era of chasing the big Parker scores is gone now, I think. Partly because the scores have all got so high that all the wines score the same, so there's no advantage from having a good critic score. It's like, well, everyone's got a high score, so it's like a... so what a lot of people are doing, are they're thoughtful people in many places, where they're going back to the vineyard and doing things right in the vineyard more than they were in the past. And in the cellar, they're rethinking their approach, and they're also rethinking their picking time as well. So I think that Bordeaux now, I think, is more interesting than it was 7 or 8 years ago. This is a Mediterranean climate wine.
So I think Bordeaux so too. I think so too, because there's a generosity of fruit and and a density and thickness and those flavours.
Cured meat, spice.
Yeah.
This is what Cabernet Sauvignon does quite well, is it adapts to climate.
But it's Cabernet Sauvignon that almost tastes like ripe Grenache in a way. Do you know what I mean? Because there's a lot... The fruit profile's different, and then you're right, like these Mediterranean flavours that are definitely there.
It's a warm, broadness, well balanced in terms of the warm climate sort of winemaking style, rich.
But it's kind of an atypical Penedès red for me, because if I think of Penedès and I think of Catalunya, which is not far away, I think of kind of lighter, brighter, fresher, crunchier. So obviously, it's interesting to see that this grape variety can ripen this well there, as well, and produce such a bold wine.
The oak is part of this flavour signature. So you're getting this spicy character, you're getting the slight warmth, dried herbs, a hint of vanilla. The oak is definitely part of that whole flavour spectrum. In its style, I think it's a good wine. It's certainly a stylistic sort of wine.
I think it's a stylistic choice to make it in that style. I would compare it, perhaps, unconsciously with Domus Cassac. We're in the sort of Languedoc and the sort of same climate in terms of heat days and, not dissimilar. But although they use oak, I find the oak really elegant, the way it's
but the Domus Cassac wines, they're certainly ripe wines, aren't they, the Domus Cassac wines?
But they also have very finely grained tannins and really good acidity because the soil much, there.
I think that I haven't tried, obviously this is the first one of this I've tried. I don't know how vintage sensitive this is. You try Cassac and they're wildly vintage sensitive, which I really like, because
so this is very true. This is the 2018 vintage of the Mas de Plana, so it's probably the current release. Released it with some age, I guess. That's the view. It's almost 7 years old.
I think also with Gassac, it's that limestone soil that, the terroir, and I like that you also get this, there's always this backbone.
There's more minerality, probably in those wines. Yeah, and it's very special terroir.
Yeah.
So,
interesting.
Cool to see, we had a real different mix of wines here today,
Yeah. But I think what's... in summary, what I think is really encouraging about the world of wine now is that instead of being like chefs in the cellar with two pans, the chefs have got 8 or 9 pans now. And a lot of wine growers are thinking more carefully about matching the means of élevage and the vessels of élevage with the styles of wines that they're making. And I think that's really exciting. And I noticed this, because I've been visiting wineries for quite a while now, and traveling, to every wine region in the world, you see that there's definitely a more of an openness to different forms of élevage.
Yeah.
Which I think is really cool, because in the past it was almost like a recipe.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're seeing this, open-mindedness and thinking about the importance of élevage in terms of shaping a wine. And, yes, of course, wine is made in the vineyard, but it's also made in the cellar. And intelligent work in the cellar, whether that's low intervention or not. I mean, to be honest, you need to be more skilled to go low intervention to produce something really expressive of your place. I think it's this key aspect of the world of wine, which is that people are realizing that to make great wine, you don't need to copy the famous regions. You can adapt what you do to suit your place.
But isn't like winemaking also about a voyage of self-discovery? So often you obviously want to respect your region, the tradition of the region, but often you also want to respect what you'd like to drink. We notice in Austria, so many of the Burgenland producers love the Jura, and their wines have transformed from being quite powerful square red wines to delicious Plusar style. And then we go to the Jura, and there's like young producers who have maybe half a hectare or a hectare to deal with, you know, to play with. They have no money, so they just got a stainless steel tank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's all the equipment they have. And eventually they'd like a barrel. And if they do have a barrel, they'll probably put their white wine in the barrel and make a carbonic red, which they release a year earlier than their white. So these are all choices and local choices and personal choices. So
there's a pragmatism, I guess. And that's actually, the other thing is that, as you say, a small barrel is quite a cost-effective and nice way of making wine. And so a lot of people will, you know, working on a small scale, that's their elevage of choice.
Yeah, and of course, if you buy second and third hand, it's so much better. So, yeah, the investment in a new barrel is a big investment, and, you know, it's going to put the wine's price up because you had to pay for it. You need to get the money back.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah, such a fascinating and topical topic in the world of wine.
And I guess also we have our personal preferences. Like I don't go bundle on tasting oak and wine, and I guess that will inform my choice on what I drink. And I'm intrigued by things like amphora, like Fevri, and the clay element, which I think Emily you said, like yeah, you can really taste it. But I quite like the sort of brickiness sometimes that it gives to a particular wine. Not every wine, but some wines. And stainless I tend to avoid, but then, you know, I love it in red wine. So I'm inconsistent.
Well, guys, fantastic to chat as usual.
Stay in touch with us by following us on Instagram at Just Another Wine Podcast. Until next time.
We'll see you then, or you'll hear us before then.
Cheers.
Cheers.